Great book of Matthew. We are in the Sermon on the Mount. This has been wonderful. As you turn to Matthew chapter 5, find your place there, and then also turn to Romans chapter 3. We saw last week Jesus saying, "Do not think that I came to destroy the law or the prophets. I did not come to destroy, but to fulfill the law." We saw last week how the law was good. The law showed God's good and perfect standard of righteousness. It just simply shows us that we're unable to live up to that. We're unable to achieve that. Now, if you got yourself in Romans chapter 3, I neglected to turn there, but let me get myself there. Romans chapter 3, and let's look at verse 19. I want to share this to start. Paul is talking about the law. Now, Romans 3:19, now we know that whatever the law says, it says to those who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped, and all the world may become guilty before God. And therefore, by the deeds of the law, no flesh will be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. That's the key there, guys. By the law is the knowledge of sin. We are aware that we're sinners in need of a Savior through the law. Now, in verse 21, but now the righteousness of God apart from the law is revealed, being witnessed by the law and the prophets, even the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ to all and on all who believe, for there is no difference. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God set forth as a propitiation by his blood, through faith to demonstrate his righteousness, because in his forbearance God had passed over the sins that were previously committed, to demonstrate at the present time his righteousness, that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. So Jesus has been addressing in his Sermon on the Mount the law. Because we saw last week how the Pharisees, the ones that interpreted and applied the law, and then also the scribes, the ones that recorded law and also interpreted law, these were people that were boasting in and prideful of the fact that they were living and carrying out the requirements of the law. But you see, Jesus comes along now and shows that keeping the law is not about outward ability, it's more about inward attitudes. Following the law, keeping the law, living up to the law is not about outward ability, it's more looking at inward attitudes. And so, though we might not be, murderers, adulterers, or liars externally, those are things that take place in our hearts inwardly, internally. And thus it leaves us lawbreakers. Now, Jesus is teaching this great message, the Sermon on the Mount, to radically alter the people's views towards godly living. And he's here to show them that narrow is the way that leads to life. And he's here to show them that he is the way to God, not living according to the law, saying Jesus is the way to God. Now, as we saw in Romans 3, Paul was writing to show that Jesus has come that we might be justified. That's why Jesus came, so that we might be justified, because the law couldn't do it. And that word justified means a lot more than just being pardoned or forgiven of sin. That word justify is a lot more weighty than that. It really means that it puts us now in a place of righteous standing, just as if we have never sinned at all. You just break that word down. Just if I never sinned. Justified. I like that. How are we justified? Romans 3:26 tells us that those that put their faith in Jesus Christ, he is the justifier of those that put their faith in him. And if we've done that, we now are seen as righteous because the record of sin is removed. Now, being justified. Let me put it this way. Let's say Madison, when she grows up, my little girl, I can't stand thinking of her being grown up, but let's say when she grows up, she begins to rack up quite a big debt at the Gap. Loves to go shopping at the Gap. And begins to rack up a huge debt on her Gap credit card. Now, of course, you know, gets to a place where she can't pay it. And of course, the Gap lawyers, well, they're going to be hot on her tail, saying, excuse me, Madison, but you are going to have to pay up. You owe us a lot. You are in heavy debt here at the Gap. Madison could plead with them all that she would like and say, listen, I'm just unable. I'm sorry. Forgive me. I just cannot pay off this debt. Well, they would insist that justice needs to be done, and they'll just say, hey, we'll see you in court. Now, let's say the day of her court hearing arrives, and the lawyers are intently seeking her out in the courtroom, ready to make an example of her, when suddenly Madison comes walking in through the court doors, hand in hand with this handsome man. The lawyers go, well, Madison, good to see you, but who's this guy with you? Oh, this guy with me, this is my fiancé, Mr. Fisher, son of Don Fisher, the president, founder, owner of the Gap. Now, let's just take care of this lawsuit, shall we? Well, the lawyers would be quick to say, lawsuit? What lawsuit? Sorry, we don't know anything about that. You see, she would be justified based on who she was with. She would be forgiven as though it never even took place based on who she was with. That's precisely how it is for us. We're lawbreakers, unable to pay the debt of sin. And Jesus showing us here on the Sermon on the Mount that we are all lawbreakers. You see, Satan is quick to accuse us. And the law is condemning us, saying that we're guilty. But into the courtroom we come, arm in arm with our bridegroom, Jesus Christ. And everything changes. We're justified. And so I wanted to bring that up with what Paul says in Romans 3, because as we started through this and began to look at Jesus addressing the law, showing that it's more about an internal manner than it is an external manner, that can leave a lot of us kind of feeling, huh, yeah, I'm a lawbreaker, I'm guilty. But yet Jesus Christ changes everything. You see, we're justified through him. So as we continue on in Matthew 5, we continue to see how the law is more than outward actions, it's inward attitudes, of which we're all guilty. We're lawbreakers, unable to live up to the lofty standards that God has given us by his law. But we just say, thanks be to Jesus Christ, who has fulfilled the law for us and justified us before the Father. You know, when we get to heaven, I think we're all going to be very surprised, because you can take the worst of the bunch that gets in there and compare him with the best of the bunch that gets in there. And I think in that comparison, we'll begin to see there's not a lot that really separates them. We're just all in there by the grace of God, justified by Jesus Christ. Because everyone has broken these commandments several times in their hearts. In fact, Jeremiah writes that the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? The heart is deceitful, desperately wicked. And we've all broken the law in our heart. Whether it's something that we think we do in an outward manner, it's something that takes place inwardly. And that's what Jesus wants to address. He says, you've heard that it was said of those of old, you shall not murder. A lot of us can say, yeah, all right. The Pharisees are saying, yes, we don't murder. But Jesus comes on and says, hey, let's look at your heart. You know, if you just even hate your brother in your heart, well, it's in the same degree as committing murder in my eyes. And so Jesus wants us to take a look at our heart, for us to do a little heart surgery today. Well, let's pick it up where we left off last week. Matthew chapter 5, let's pick it up in verse 27. Matthew 5, verse 27. He goes on to say here, as he's addressing his disciples, and no doubt many that were listening, trying to eavesdrop, tuning into what Jesus was saying here, Jesus continues to say, you have heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that whoever looks at a woman to lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So Jesus, again, just continues on in the flow of what he's saying. He says, guys, it's a heart issue here. Many of us can say, yeah, we've never committed adultery. We've never cheated on our spouse. We've never done anything as crazy or as sinful or as awful as that. Jesus says, well, that's great. But listen, here's the deal. It's the matters of the heart. If you just look at a woman, if you just look at another man and you begin to lust after them, Jesus is saying it's basically you're committing adultery in your heart. And thus, we're all seen as adulterers. And we're just confirming what Paul said in Romans 3:10. There is none righteous, no, not one. And that's the point that Jesus is trying to say here. There is no one that's righteous, none. We're all lawbreakers, all sinners. Now, Jesus is not saying that the act of adultery and adultery in the heart is the same thing in the sense that it's to the same degree. He's just showing that they are both sin and they are both in violation of the law. Now, again, the Pharisees were so prideful in being able to say, yes, we live out the law. We follow the law. We are righteous people. And in everybody's eyes, the Pharisees and the scribes, they were definitely the spiritual superstars. Remember what we said? There was a common saying in that day that said, if only two people make it into heaven, one will be a Pharisee, the other will be a scribe. You see, the people thought, these guys are the spiritual giants. If I can just live up to their righteousness. And they were very prideful in the fact that they were living the law outwardly. And in regards to this, they were people that said, well, we don't want to look at anything and covet. We don't want to look at anything and commit adultery in our heart. We don't want to break the law, you know, by the things that we do outwardly. And so they would kind of walk around, cover their eyes. They had a nickname in this day. They were known as the headbangers. Not because they spent a lot of time in the mosh pits at rock concerts. That's not the kind of headbangers like we associate with today. They were called headbangers because they would walk along saying, I can't look at that. I don't want to covet. And we got to fulfill the law outwardly. And so they would walk around with their heads down, eyes kind of covered, and they would bang into walls. They would bang into people. They were known as the headbangers. So prideful on trying to live out the law outwardly. Jesus says, if you just, you know, look at a woman lustfully, well, you've committed adultery in your heart. Well, what are we to do then? You know, we're trying to cover our eyes and we're keeping our eyes from looking at these things so that we do not sin. Well, Jesus now says, hey, if it's your eye that's giving you a problem, if you are worried about a wandering eye here, well, just go and pluck it out. Look at what he says here. He says, if your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. For it's more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. And he goes on to say, if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it from you. For it's more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell. He says, if it's your eyes that you're worried about, keeping your eyes covered, well, why don't you just pluck it out? It's more profitable that one of your members should perish than your whole body go to hell. Just pluck it out, if that's the problem. Well, you know, and I had a lot of difficulty with a verse like this when I was growing up reading this verse. I like to skip over that one because I thought, man, if that's what it takes, there's going to be nothing left of me, you know. Now, let me explain to you what Jesus is really saying here before I have half the church coming back next Sunday with eye patches over their eye or, you know, bandages over their hands or limbs shorter than the next one. You know, that wouldn't be good. You know, there have been people that have taken this verse and said, well, man, I've got a problem with lust. And they've actually taken a fork or knife and they've plucked their eye out. There's been people that have literally taken this verse literally and they've chopped their hand off. But let me tell you guys, there are blind people in the world that still struggle with lust. There are thieves with no hands. Do you understand that sin still takes place in your heart? Jesus is not saying to literally gouge out your eye, literally cut off your hand. Because if that's what it takes, then like I said, we would just devour ourselves. We would ultimately kill ourselves because we'd have to chop off every little bit of the flesh. Jesus is saying we need to take a look again at the heart. We need to look at the heart. He's saying that we need to be those that are willing to sacrifice for the sake of obedience. Cutting off a hand or plucking out your eye is not going to keep you from sin. Do you understand this? It's not going to keep you from sin because it's still an area of the heart, a matter of the heart. Sin can still take place in the heart. But surrendering that area of temptation over to Christ is a good start. And that's what Jesus is talking about. We need to take drastic measures here. We need to be willing to cut off those things that are causing us to stumble and fall, causing us to sin. Maybe you've got a problem with lust. Well, you know, cut off things that you might be seeing on TV that feed that. Cut off going to areas that maybe foster that feeling or that temptation. Stay away from things that you know you are weak in. Jesus is saying that we need to be willing to take decisive, drastic measures in cutting off those areas in our lives that lead to temptation, that lead to sin. But it's not in doing it outwardly. It's again a matter of the heart, determining and deciding to do that inwardly. We need to take serious action against sin. And that's what Jesus is really talking about here. Taking serious action against sin. You might think, oh Lord, how can I live without that one thing? I love it, I cherish it. Well, it's more profitable for you that that area should perish than for your whole life to end up in hell. Oh Lord, I don't know if I could live without seeing that movie or watching that show, even though I know it might not be that healthy for me. It's more profitable for you to cut that out than for it to lead down the path of destruction. It's an area of the heart, a matter of the heart. Verse 31, furthermore, it's been said, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But I say to you that whoever divorces his wife for any reason except sexual immorality causes her to commit adultery, and whoever marries a woman who is divorced commits adultery. Now, interesting. Whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. But Jesus says, hey, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality commits adultery. Now, there were two schools of thought that people kind of lined up under regarding divorce. And it all stemmed from Deuteronomy 24:1, some instructions regarding, you know, divorcing your wife, writing a certificate of divorce. If you're taking notes, write that down, Deuteronomy 24:1, and in the next few verses you can look at that later. But in there it says that you may divorce, or if there is an area of uncleanness in your wife, you may write a certificate of divorce. Well, there were two schools of thought that were formed in trying to interpret what that meant in unclean. What's it mean when Moses writes that if your wife is unclean? What does that mean? So there were two popular Jewish rabbis in this day. There was Rabbi Shammai. He was a conservative guy, and he said that word unclean really just is referring to sexual immorality. If your wife goes and commits adultery, well then you may write a certificate of divorce and it's grounds for divorce. But then there was Rabbi Hillel. The people loved Rabbi Hillel because he was a liberal. And Rabbi Hillel said that word unclean doesn't just refer to sexual immorality. It can refer to a whole bunch of things. You see, if your wife just causes you to maybe get upset or causes you to sin in some way, well, she's been unclean. She's caused you to sin. In other words, they would teach, if your wife burns your toast at breakfast and you get really upset about that, that's grounds for divorce because she's caused anger. She's caused you to sin. She's made herself unclean. Or if your wife is talking negatively about your parents, that's not good. That's just showing herself to be unclean. You can divorce her over that. And they began to make a whole long list over certain things that your wife could do. And it was real, real loose, real liberal. And they also said this. They said, listen, men, if you're out walking the streets and you find a woman that's more virtuous, more righteous than your wife? Well, just in comparison now, your wife would be unclean. In comparison to this woman, that was much more virtuous. She attended the synagogue a lot more regularly. Oh, so now my wife's unclean. And they could just simply say three times, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you. Write a certificate, and there you go. Done. I'm moving on. Not very unlike today, is it? Where divorce has begun to be something that is just taken very frivolously, very loosely. Yeah, you know, I'm just tired of the way my wife looks at me, or I'm tired of my husband just kind of lounging around. Yeah, I think it's time for divorce. And so there were these two schools of thought regarding divorce. Now, in effect, these verses declare that when you divorce and remarry, you are committing adultery. You see, that was never God's desire for marriage. His desire, you go right back to Genesis chapter 2, and you will see that his desire for marriage was for man and wife to come together and be one flesh. One flesh in a way where they are one, where you just don't separate. Because there is a real harm that comes. There is not now in divorce and separation, it's not just two people coming apart. Okay, you go your way, I'm going to go my way. No. Because when you're one, you are ripping that apart, and now there's just a fraction of each left to go their way. And that was never God's desire for divorce. Never God's intent. Now, when we get to Matthew chapter 19, we'll maybe be there next week or... No, I'm just kidding. But when we get to Matthew 19 down the road, we're going to cover this whole area of marriage and divorce a little more in depth, because Jesus deals with it in a little more detail. And so I'm not going to go on a lot longer on this, but we'll save it for Matthew 19. But I just want to say that it's not God's desire for two people to divorce in that way. It was allowed in the case of unfaithfulness, but again, it was if the spouse was living a lifestyle of immorality and adultery. It was not in the case where maybe there was a momentary lapse, a slip, an error of judgment, and you say, oh, you blew it now, we're divorcing. Because there should ultimately, as believers, always there should be the desire for reconciliation and restoration of relationships. That is always our desire as believers, as Christians. Should always be our goal. But let me just say this, and we'll move on. As I said, in effect, these verses declare that when you divorce and remarry, you commit adultery. You are not, however, living in adultery. Now, sadly, the church and Christians, again, two views. They've either taken divorce too lightly and said, it's no big deal. I can move on and, you know, that's fine. I'm just not happy with this marriage and I'm sure this was never God's will for me, so I'm just going to move on. And there are those as Christians in the church that can take it very lightly. And there are also, on the other side, those that kind of put a real black mark upon those that have been divorced. And sadly, that's going to the extreme the other way. And people view those that are divorced as though they've committed the unpardonable sin. Pastors no longer can marry those people in a ceremony if they're divorced in certain religious bodies. And some have been, in the eyes of certain religious bodies, disqualified from ministry because they've been divorced in the past. And they treat this as though it's kind of the unpardonable sin. Oh, man. And again, that was never God's desire for that as well. It's sin like any other. And when we look at it that way, then we'd all be disqualified from serving. We'd all be disqualified from the ministry. No, God is one that loves to transform and renew us for His glory. And did you know that God chose one to be in the genealogy of Jesus who was an adulterer? Bathsheba. You see, God can still work through and use people that have had that kind of background. And we don't need to look at them and go, oh, divorce, well, sorry, you know. We'll love upon you, but we're just not going to have you use in any area. That's unfortunate. Because God is a God of second chances. But we don't want to be like the world that just takes it loosely either. Let's move on to verse 33. Again, you've heard that it was said to those of old, you shall not swear falsely, but shall perform your oaths to the Lord. But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by the earth, for it is His footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great King. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you cannot make one hair white or black. You see, the Pharisees took Leviticus 19:12 that said, you shall not swear by my name falsely. And so they took that and thought, well, we won't swear by His name, but we'll swear by other things. That way, if we kind of tell a lie, or, you know, if we maybe break our word, well, then we're not profaning the Lord's name. So they come up to people and say, hey, you know, let me tell you this story. Yeah, it's true, honestly. I swear on Jerusalem. I swear on the earth, I swear on the heavens, I swear by my own head. They would say, this is true, I'm telling you fact, this is it, man, I swear to you. And they would take oaths and they would swear upon anything that they could, just not swearing on the Lord's name, lest they profane it, because the law forbids that to happen. So they said, we want to fulfill the law outwardly, and so we're not going to use His name. But they would go and break their word and think, well, you know, oh, well, at least I didn't profane the Lord's name there. I guess I won't be held accountable for that then. And they would be people that were not being very trustworthy. You see, the only reason you would need to take an oath or swear by something is because your word isn't true. And because people just don't trust you. Have you ever felt, you know, seen kids like this? I swear, honest. I'm not exaggerating. I did see a dinosaur out on the playground there. I swear, honest. And, you know, they're just, you know, and they're just quick to throw out these words and everything like that. You know, when I was growing up, a group of friends that I had from a young age, right from elementary, we had a word that we used. Now, you see, we love to joke with people, and we love to, you know, to just mess with people and, you know, tell stories and fibs and things of that. And so, of course, we just began to not trust one another. Now, these are all still guys that I hang out with today, you know, and, you know, of course, we're trying to change all this. But, you see, we just began to not be very trustworthy of one another. And so we had a word. The word was trust. Now, I got a friend here today, Gord, that I grew up with. Gord, you remember that, right? Trust? Trust, you do. There you go. Gord knows about this. And you see, we would talk to people, and we'd be saying things, and you know, maybe we'd be out camping somewhere and say, hey, let's go jump in the lake. Okay, if you jump in, I'll jump in. And we'd be all like, oh, yeah, right. You know, trust? Say it, trust. You know, we'd be like, trust. And then we know, okay. And that word was gold, man. If they said that word, trust, they had to do it, man. Because if they didn't, oh, man, that was wrong. That was the unpardonable sin right there. You know what I'm saying? And of course, we began to find ways to get around this word. We would, you know, if we still want to trick somebody or one of our friends, you know, and, hey, you jump in. If you jump in, I'll jump in after you. And, you know, trust. And we'd say, trust, without, you know, saying T on the end, and try to make him, or we'd say thrust and say it real quick to make it sound like we're saying trust. And we'd be kind of like, you know, say it again. Did you said, no way. You know, we just try to convince ourselves, and we grew up, you know, just being very untrustworthy of one another. I don't know if that's good or not, but we're still friends today. Gord's here, and that's good. And Gord, forgive me, but, and it's all fine. It's all good. But you see, sadly, our word wasn't enough. And for many people, their word isn't enough. God wants us as believers to be people where our character is integral, where we don't have to convince people we're telling the truth. He just says, be a person of your word. He says, let your yes be yes and your no, no. For whatever is more than these is from the evil one. In other words, when somebody asks you something or you're telling something, just let your yes be yes. That's it. Yeah, that's it. Or no, that's not it. And that's it. You don't have to say, no, honest, I swear, no. Or yes, seriously, trust, honestly. God says, man, just let your yes be yes and your no, no. Be people of your word. Don't have to swear or take oaths, because when you do that, it's showing that your word isn't true in itself. And that's not what Jesus intends for his followers. And then he says, you have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. Now, of course, they got the law here, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, from Exodus chapter 21, where Moses begins to expand on, you know, various civil laws with his people. Now, this law was meant to be a limitation, not an obligation. Big difference there. Because the people began to say, well, we've got to carry out the law again. The Pharisees said, we've got to follow the law. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. That means if somebody comes and knocks out my tooth, and it's my eye tooth right here on the left side, well, I got to go and track that brother down. I've got to do what the law tells me. I have to do it. I got to track him down, pin him down. You know, somebody get me a rock. I got to knock out. Nope, sorry, not that tooth. It's got to be this tooth. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Knock that tooth out. Okay, there you go. We're even. God originally intended that law in the book of Exodus to be a limitation, to be a law where they show mercy, because it's human tendency to always want to get one up on the other. Oh, I was like that. I tell you, I certainly was. Somebody did something to me, if it was a prank or something, I said, well, they're going to pay, man. I'm going to get even. I'm not going to just get even with them. I'm going to get one up. Because that's oftentimes what human nature tells us. That's what we want to do. We're going to make them pay. They're going to see that they don't mess with me and get away with it. God says, man, it's just an eye for an eye. You don't need to go above and beyond. You don't need to go overboard in trying to bring out justice. Just eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth. But then Jesus comes and says something a lot more radical. He says this, I tell you not to resist an evil person, but whoever slaps you on your right cheek, turn the other to him also. Wow. If someone comes against you, Jesus says, turn your cheek. Give him extra. In other words, he says, show the law of love. And Paul would write in Romans chapter 13, owe no one anything except to love one another. For he who loves another has fulfilled the law. He says, for the commandments, you shall not commit adultery, you shall not murder, you shall not steal, you shall not bear false witness, you shall not covet. And if there's any other commandment, they're all summed up in this saying, namely, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. He goes on to say, love does no harm to a neighbor. Therefore, love is the fulfillment of the law. Jesus says, if you want to fulfill the law, it's not eye for an eye, tooth for tooth. If you want to fulfill the law, show love. Turn the other cheek and give your cloak to those that ask for your tunic. Wow. And then he says, whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him too. You see, they were under Roman rule in this day. They were under the Roman law. And in this day, if a Roman soldier came up behind you and tapped his spear on your shoulder, he was saying, you got to carry my bag. And every person was obligated, if they were tapped on the shoulder, to carry the soldier's bag. Their armor, whatever was in it. But they were only obligated to carry it for 1 mile. They would go and walk, and they couldn't sit there and go, oh man, I don't really want to, I'm busy. No, they were obligated to do it. So the person would pick up the bag and walk for a mile with the soldier. But once the mile came up, they said, okay, here you go, here's your stuff. My job's done here. I don't need to go anymore. But Jesus says, hey, go with him another mile. Go the extra mile here. Go with him 2 miles. Could you imagine that? The soldier coming up to a mile says, okay, that's fine, drop your bag. And then you just kind of say, hey, no, that's cool, man. Where are you heading to? You just going up there? Let's go. I'll help you out. Come on. Let's go. I'll keep carrying it for you. No problem. It's no big deal. Could you imagine the soldier, his face, his reaction to that? Are you serious? You see, people would have hated the fact that they needed to carry the bag. In fact, the soldiers probably took delight in that person carrying the bag, just grumbling under their breath. Oh, man, I can't wait for the Messiah to come and just overthrow all this. You're going to pay me. Oh, man. And I could just see the soldiers taking delight in these people, just mumbling under their breath. But then all of a sudden, you have somebody that comes up and says, hey, I'm not, no, that's fine. 1 mile out, that's nothing. Let's keep going. Come on, where are you heading to? Let's go. I'll join you. I'll take your bag, no problem. Could you imagine the soldier now, his reaction going, what in the world? Is this guy's off his rocker? Could you imagine the opportunity that you would have just to go and share with him? Because no doubt the guy's going to keep walking and go, why? Why are you doing this? You're only entitled to taking a mile. That's it. You can drop it. Why are you doing this? And you can just walk him and say, hey, you know what? The Lord's just been so good to me. You know, God just loves me, and he's just showing me that, you know what? I just want to serve other people. I want to help people because the Lord's helped me in such a wonderful way, man. He's come and given me life, hope, something to look forward to. Man, I just want to be a blessing. And think of the witnessing that can begin to happen when you are people that begin to go the extra mile for people. And that can happen. And you know what? A few Saturdays ago, we had that Love Langley. It was a day where different churches just went out and said, you know what? We just want to bless the community. And we're not asking for anything. We're not looking for anything. We just want to go and bless people. You know, it was awesome to see people come and get their cars washed for free, or people have their groceries paid for, or lawns mowed. And they just said, hey, we're just going to do this for nothing. We just want to help you out. Man, people were just blown off their seats as they said, wow, what compels someone to do this? It's just the love of God in my life that I want to have poured out through me. And people are touched. When you go the extra mile, when you say, hey, can I help you with that? People don't expect it. And that's the key. When people aren't expecting it, and you just come up and say, hey, let me help you with that. Let me carry that out to your car for you. Or, you know, let me take care of that for you. Man, people are blown away. And it's an opportunity to say, hey, you know what? The Lord's just been good to me. And I just take delight in sharing that with other people. And you'll be blessed too. Give to him who asks you, and from him who wants to borrow from you, do not turn away. Now, that is within reason, of course. We need to be free, Jesus is saying, to give, to help others. When you see somebody in need, don't have such a tight possession on your things that you say, you know what, I just can't part with this. I know that person would really be blessed through it, but, oh, man. Man, just have a real light grip on your stuff and be willing and able to give to people in need. But, you know, within reason, because there might be people that come up and just begin to take advantage of you. Say, hey, I know that guy's one of those Christian type people, and, you know, when they just want to give to people, well, let's just, you know, really tell them a sad, you know, sob story, and they're going to give us money, or they're going to do that for us, and they just keep coming back week in and week out. Of course, you know, I mean, we need to be within reason and just have God's wisdom in that, but God says, be willing and quick to help those that are in need. Do not turn them away. And then verse 43, you have heard that it was said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. Well, of course we know it said love your neighbor. But hate your enemy, that was something that they added to their law. They kind of did the action-reaction thing here. Well, the action, love your neighbor, well, there's got to be a reaction. Okay, hate your enemy. That sounds good to me. And again, that was never God's desire. For there to be hatred towards anyone. And again, Jesus is dissecting their hearts here. He says, but I say to you in verse 44, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the just and on the unjust. Jesus is showing here that love will always win out. It will bless others, and even more importantly, it will bless you, guys. It will bless you. He says, pray for your enemies. Could you imagine that? Praying for your enemies. That would have been very, very profound to the Pharisees here. Pray for your enemies. Are you kidding me? But you see, there's something great that takes place. You see, when we pray, yeah, God does things. And God will move. But more importantly, you see, not only will others be changed, but more importantly, our hearts are changed. We will begin to look at those that we consider enemies in a different light, in a different way, with a different attitude. We'll begin to say, wow, we're coming alongside them in prayer. We're partnering with them. We're asking for the Lord to bless them. How can I stay angry at those people? How can I stay bitter towards that person when I'm saying, Jesus, bless them. Jesus, love upon them. You see, God's going to begin to do a work in your own heart when you're people that begin to pray for your enemies. We don't pray, God, change them. Oh, God, you've got a big work to do in that person's life. Yes. Now, when we pray, yes, God can do that. But more importantly, God will begin to work in your heart. And you will quickly begin to find your attitude changing. And your thought towards that person you saw as an enemy, you'll see it begin to change. God will do that work. Jesus said in John 13:35, by this all will know that you are my disciples if you have love for one another. Be people that love. You know, even God doesn't show partiality. Look at verse 45, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes his sun rise on the evil and on the good, and he sends rain on the just and on the unjust. Don't be people that are being partial where you're saying, you know, that person there, I've got nothing to do with them. That person there, oh, they're pretty cool. I'm going to hang out with them. God doesn't even show partiality. God doesn't say, they're unjust, they're evil, so they're not going to get any blessing. No, God says, hey, I send the rain upon them. I make the sun rise upon them just as I would with any other person. God is good, even to those who are evil. And he says, for if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? Remember, Matthew was a tax collector, former name Levi, and so he knew what that was like. Even the tax collectors can do that kind of thing. And he says, if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do so? Therefore, you shall be perfect, just as your Father in heaven is perfect. See, it's easy to show kindness to those that demonstrate it back. And Jesus is not talking about a natural kind of love that we give out. He's talking about a supernatural kind of love that flows out from our lives. And we need to be connected to the vine that we'd be people that bear fruit. Fruit that the world seldom sees. Because the world sees people at odds, fighting with one another. But when they see Christians coming and just loving upon those that might persecute them, being kind to those that are hard to them, being helpful to those that just turn their backs on the Christians, the world doesn't normally see that kind of fruit. Jesus says, I want you to demonstrate that. Love those who maybe aren't always loving towards you. Because if you just love those that love you, what reward have you? That's simple. The world does that. But the world doesn't see the other side of that. He says, I want you to be different than the world. I want you to begin to demonstrate that. And let there be that supernatural outflow of love in your lives that bears fruit. And then he says in the end here, therefore you shall be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect. He says, you got to be perfect. Many people that say, hey, you know what, this Christianity thing, I just kind of live by the Ten Commandments. That's sort of my gospel. Or others will say, I just live by the Sermon on the Mount, you know, that whole thing. Man, that's kind of my gospel. That's what I live by. That's what's going to get me to heaven. Well, Jesus says, hey, If you're going to live by the commandments, if you're going to live by the Sermon on the Mount, you got to be perfect. Because that's what it's teaching us. God's standard of righteousness is perfection. And the issue is this: we cannot live up to perfection in ourselves. The law shows that we're sinners in need of a Savior. The Sermon on the Mount shows us in even more detail that, wow, we break the law all the time in our hearts. Whether it's something we think we do outwardly or not, it's something that takes place in our hearts all the time. We need perfection. And I'm glad that there's one that is perfect, Jesus Christ, who has come and fulfilled the law for us, that with him we might have a righteous standing, that through him we might be justified. Now, even more than living a perfect life, what I believe Jesus is really even more saying here: you shall be perfect just as your Father in heaven is perfect. He's saying, I want you to be mature. I want you to be growing in these things. He's not talking about be perfect necessarily in a sinless perfection. No, that's what is required if you follow the law. But he's saying, I'm not looking for you to be perfect sinlessly. I'm looking for you to be mature, to be complete. Don't focus on external things, but internal things. Grow in those areas that are a matter of the heart. Continue to grow in them so that people begin to see your fruit, so that people begin to see your lives, so that, again, as we saw last week, you begin to be the salt of the earth, the light of the world, that people see and go, wow, I take notice of that. That's different than what I see in the world. Jesus wants us to be different than the world. And he's saying, I want you to be continuing to mature and be complete in these things, growing in me. We need to be connected to that vine, abiding in the vine, that we would bear fruit. Let's pray.